Thank you.
Actually starts it right after the kids go down for the.
Are you live streaming now?
Not live streaming, but we do post.
All right, so those of you who were here last month heard the story about the pamphlet I received in the mail from a man named Chuck Roberts telling me the five things that God wanted me to know and how to repent so that I can make it into heaven. And for those of you who weren't here last month, it's true. So I mailed a letter back to him thanking him for sharing his spiritual path with me, and I enclosed a Guy's Temple brochure to return the favor. And about a week later, I got his response, and I wanted to share that with you. Now, I want you to know that I signed the letter, Reverend Judith Laxer, but he responded, Dear Guy's Temple, thank you for your kind response and for sending me the brochure, Guy's Temple. I've read it, but of course I don't agree with it, just like you didn't agree with my little booklet. But that's the true meaning of tolerance. That is, we agree to disagree agreeably. Sincerely, Chuck Roberts. So at first I thought, okay, I'll write him back and I'll say, you know, it's a big mosaic and we're all our own tiles. And you know, my whole mind looks like, Judith, just let that rest. But I thought it was a beautiful thing and I wanted to share that little thing, just for a little closure for all of us. I mean, what a beautiful thing, right? Yes. We agree to disagree agreeably. Blessed be. Can I get a blessed be? All right, so here we are just 10 days from the vernal equinox, also called Ostara, the peak of spring on the wheel of the year, on March 20th, to be exact, this year at 4:02 a.m., and when the sun goes into Aries. It is one of the two 24-hour periods of equal day and equal night, the other being the autumnal equinox, approximately six moons from now. And at this time, we enter into the light half of the year in the season of warmth and growth. Yahoo. And we do notice that the days are lengthening. The twilight doesn't arrive. I looked last night. It was 6:30, and it still was just becoming twilight, as opposed to 4 o'clock, which is what happens in the depth of winter here in the Northwest. So typically, we enjoy the light half of the year more than the dark. And since we also typically associate the light half of the year with warmer weather, it's good to take note, both in our era of climate change, and especially here in the soggy Northwest, that it is lighter, longer day by day. So do take note of that. It might not be warmer or drier yet, but it is indeed lighter, longer. So take that in. And taking it in means spending more time out of doors. And, you know, we can do that by greeting the crocus, the primrose, praising the green shoots that will bloom into tulips and daffodils, encouraging the buds, and the daphne that smells so yum, 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 exactly. We can thank the perennials for being, well, perennial. The garlic for emerging in the garden bed, the hummingbird for sweeping by, the robin redbreast, a sure sign of spring. Watch the constellations move in the heaven as the earth shifts on her axis, and the crone moon still visible first thing in the morning. Mother Nature is beautiful, and she is everywhere awakening. And that is the cue I didn't give you earlier, ladies, so here you go. Yeah. Mercury's retrograde, and that's all I'm saying. Each year in the service in March, I relay the story of the return of the maiden goddess, now Queen Persephone, as she rises to the surface of the earth from the great realm of death below with her beloved Hades. The story includes not only the resurrection and renewal of the life force, which is always welcome and appreciated, but also the joy of reunion, the great mother and child reunion Paul Simon sung about back in the 70s, right? The course of a lifetime runs over and over again. Well, I would not give false hope on this great and mournful day, but the mother and child reunion is only a moment away. Exactly. Okay. Anyway, so after the long, dark, deep winter, this reunion of mother and daughter, this metaphor for the return of the light and the life force, the creative life force of nature, just a moment away, is happily anticipated. But this year, I want to talk about another annual springtime celebration. Mm-hmm. the one that occurs next Sunday, St. Patrick's Day. So, my wee lads and lasses, let's travel way further north of Greece and a little further west to the Isle of Erin. Long before I discovered I was pagan, I remember learning that the Catholic St. Patrick celebrated on March 17th, next Sunday, which I recently learned was the day of his death, by some accounts in 460 and by other accounts 493 AD, so either way in the 5th century. But anyway, bless you, it is celebrated for driving the snakes out of Ireland. That's what I learned. Catholic St. Patrick drove the snakes out of Ireland. I'm sure you've all seen those little cartoons of him sitting behind the wheel and there's snakes in the back seat saying, are we there yet? And you know. Anyway, he's driving the snakes out of Ireland. So literal. Anyway, and then after I discovered I was pagan, I realized what that really meant. And that's what I want to talk with you about today. So first, a bit of history about Patrick himself. And you see, we're already on a first name basis. I was quite surprised to learn that Patrick is not Irish. Did you know? Celtic, yes, but specifically Irish, no. He was a Romanized Briton whose name was Magonus Sucatus Patricius. It's a mouthful. His father was a deacon and his grandfather was a priest, but the story goes that his family was not particularly religious. Rather, they became clergy for the financial and social benefits, which... but anyway, the benefits... really? But the benefits of that was becoming exempt from military service and exempt from paying taxes. And in this way, his family was quite well off. When Patrick was 16 years of age, his family estate was raided and looted by the pagan Irish, and some accounts they say the pagan Irish pirates. Like, I thought pirates were by land. Arrgh! But anyway. And he was captured, taken to Ireland, and sold as a slave. And then for the next 6 years, he worked as a shepherd for an Irish chieftain. And it was said that during this time, that that's when Patrick's faith in God developed, that he prayed over 100 times a day, and by some accounts, 100 times a night, to be released from slavery and to be able to return to his family. So at the end of 6 years, Patrick was visited by an angel who told him that the time was right to escape and to travel by foot the 200 miles to the Irish coast where he would find passage on a ship back home. And so he did. And not long after, he received another revelatory vision, and this time the angel told him that he would be returning to Ireland on a mission to both minister to the already Christianized Irish and by bringing the word of God to convert the rest. And this part of the story contradicts several accounts of it. Some say that Patrick actually brought Christianity to Ireland for the first time. So, but one way or another, we know that Patrick, and after the next 15 years of religious study and training, became a missionary and returned to the land in which he was once enslaved. So the history website tells us, and I quote, familiar with the Irish language and culture, Patrick chose to incorporate traditional ritual into the lessons of Christianity instead of attempting to eradicate native Irish beliefs. For instance, he used bonfires to celebrate Easter, since the Irish were used to honoring their gods with fire. He also superimposed a sun, a powerful Irish symbol, onto the Christian cross to create what is now called a Celtic cross, so that veneration of the symbol would seem more natural to the Irish. Although there was a small number of Christians on the island when Patrick arrived, most Irish practice a nature-based pagan religion. The Irish culture centered around a rich tradition of oral legend and myth, and when this is considered, it is no surprise that the story of Patrick's life became exaggerated over the centuries, spinning exciting tales to remember history, which has always been a part of the Irish way of life. So we know what that really means. It means that pagan practices were co-opted to help make the new imposed theology more palatable to the indigenous cultures. For example, one interesting little factoid I discovered is that the shamrock, which plays a prominent role in St. Patrick's Day decor, was a teaching tool used by Patrick. He taught that the three leaves of the clover that grew naturally and prolifically in Ireland represented the Holy Trinity, the three aspects of God as the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, which we say Holy Spirit now. But prior to this appropriation, and although I don't know that a shamrock was used as her symbol specifically, the Holy Trinity comprised the triple goddess as maiden, mother, and crone. Now, just remember that if you find a four-leaf clover, don't iron it, because you don't want to press your luck. I'm sorry, I had to. Then there's another one. What do you get when you cross a four-leaf clover with poison ivy? A rash of good luck. Anyway, spoo-hiss. It's not as bad as some of the Irish limericks I found, so there you go. That was the only one I thought was clever enough to use. Anyway, so about those snakes. So the chorus of one Irish folk song reads, "Success to bold St. Paddy's fist, he was a saint so clever. He gave the snakes and toads a twist and banished them forever." And then another one goes like this. "There's ne'er a mile in Ireland's isle where the dirty vermin musters. Where'er he put his dear forefoot, he murdered them in clusters. The toads went hop, the snakes went flop, slap dash into the water. And the beasts committed suicide to save themselves from slaughter." Makes you want to dance a jig, doesn't it? So, according to Russell McClendon, who blogs about science, politics, and other earthly matters, Ireland didn't have snakes in the first place due to its geographical location and glacial history. When snakes first evolved about 100 million years ago, slithering around the ancient supercontinent, Ireland was still underwater. And as continents drifted and the sea levels changed, Ireland eventually rose up from the Atlantic and was even briefly linked to Britain and mainland Europe by land bridges. But as the Smithsonian Institution explains, any snake that may have slithered its way to Ireland would have turned into a popsicle when the ice ages hit. Perennially frozen ground is unkind to cold-blooded animals, so Ireland stayed snake-free until it finally thawed about 15,000 years ago. And while snakes could have invaded after that, there was still one problem, the ocean. Thanks to 12 miles of chilly seawater separating it from Britain, Ireland is now one of just 5 major land masses on Earth with no native snakes, joining Antarctica, Greenland, Iceland, and New Zealand. So if Ireland never had any snakes, then what's all the fuss about? And how did this story, despite the Irish propensity to spin a good yarn, get going, and what does it mean? Well, Patrick's other claim to fame is converting Irish pagans to Christianity, which we all know is a religion like its predecessor, Judaism, that demonizes snakes. And so we can see that this myth is a metaphor for the removal of the religion that came before it, the religion that associated serpents with many of the Celtic goddesses and those who preceded them from other parts of the globe and from religions far older, revering the serpent for its regenerative power and wisdom. Wikipedia tells us that in religion, mythology, and literature, snakes represent fertility and the creative life force. In Hinduism, that life force is called Kundalini and is a coiled serpent. Kind of like what I have on the altar. I actually tried this on, it looked good as a necklace too, but I thought it was more of an altar piece. Anyway, in Hinduism, this life force is called Kundalini and it is a coiled serpent, the residual power of pure desire. It's described as a sleeping, dormant potential force in the human organism that remains coiled on the pelvic floor until it is awakened through yogic, creative, and/or sexual practices. And then it rises up through the chakra system, awakening the different energies for enlightenment. This sacred force or empowerment is the primordial cosmic energy and represents the dynamic forces that are thought to move through the entire universe. Known as Shakti, it is the concept or the personification of divine feminine creative power, sometimes referred to as the Great Divine Mother in Hinduism. And on the earthly plane, Shakti most actively manifests through female embodiment and creativity and fertility, though of course it's also present in males in its potential and unmanifest form, that is, until it is awakened and manifests. So from this perspective, we see that the energy of creativity and sexuality is a sacred thing to be developed and practiced in a devotional and religious way. This is very different from the Abrahamic religions, which also teach us that the serpent represents sexual desire and passion, but not as a good thing. After all, it is the serpent that causes all the trouble in the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? I'm sorry, the serpent and the woman who caused the fall from grace. Don't be wise now. Don't let that natural wisdom of your body lead you astray. Why, you're not even supposed to know you're naked. Here, have a fig leaf or two. Cover up those shameful body parts. And there the dysfunction begins. Because serpents shed their skin, they are symbols of rebirth, transformation, immortality, and healing. The Ouroboros, or Ouroboros, I've heard it pronounced two ways, which depicts a serpent in the shape of a circle with its tail in its mouth, is a symbol of eternity and continual renewal of life. This is quite different conceptually from the religious teaching of one life, in which we must follow strict rules of conduct, usually that seek to suppress sexual desire and passion in order to save our sinful souls. Very, very different. The serpent's connection to healing is an interesting one. Snake's venom is associated with the chemicals of plants and fungi, or fungi. How do you say that? Do you say fungi?
Fungi.
Fungi. Fungi. I like saying that. Fungi. That have the power to either heal, poison, or provide expanded consciousness through divine intoxication. For this reason, it was considered to be one of the wisest animals, nearly divine in itself. Now, this divine aspect, combined with its habitat in the earth between the roots of plants, made it an animal with chthonic properties connected to the underworld and the afterlife and immortality. Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine and healing, carried a staff with one serpent wrapped around it, which has become the symbol of modern medicine. Now, sometimes we'll see this staff with two snakes and wings on the top, and that's called the caduceus, but that's often mistaken to symbolize medicine, but actually, it's the symbol of commerce and business. Health, business. The concepts of serpent wisdom, healing and immortality and regeneration, which included reincarnation, of course, are all at the foundation of pagan belief. In pre-Christian Gaul, now France, and in Ireland, this belief was taught by the Druids, an order of pagan priests from the Iron Age and possibly even earlier. It's hard to really know the specifics about the Druids because one of their tenets was oral tradition and they didn't trust anything to writing. So nothing has come passed down to us that we can say, oh, see, right here, I read it here. Part of becoming initiated into the Druidic order included becoming tattooed with serpents, symbolizing these mysteries, using the blue dye derived from the plants called woad, which also has healing properties. The word Druid means both oak and to know, so it very well might literally mean those who know the oak. And it is widely accepted that Druids revered and kept holy the ancient oak groves of all the Celtic nations, wherein mistletoe, another prized herb for its healing and magical properties, grew on their branches. The Christian website The New Advent tells us that the word Druid had two meanings. In the stricter sense, it meant the teachers of moral philosophy and science. And in the wider sense, it included the priests, diviners, judges, teachers, physicians, astronomers, and philosophers. They were regarded as the most just of men, and disputes, both public and private, were referred to them for settlement. Thus, their influence was much more than just a social or a religious one, in spite of the common opinion that they were exclusively a priestly caste. Above all, the Druids were the educators of nobility. Their instruction was varied and extensive, and consisted of a large number of verses learned by heart, and we are told that sometimes up to 20 years were required to complete the course of study. That's a lot of memory. The Druids held that their learning should not be consigned to writing, which I've already said, and they must have had a considerable oral literature of sacred songs and formula and prayers, rules of divination and magic. But all of this, of all this lore, not one verse has come down to us, either in our own language or in the form of translation, nor is there even a legend that we can call with certitude Druidic. Their instruction was secret and carried on in caves and forests of oak. In the saga tales of Ireland, they are most often found in the service of kings who employed them as advisors because of their magical powers. They were magicians, diviners, physicians, and teachers, and not as the representatives of a certain religion. Now, I'm not surprised that the Christian website would not consider them representatives of a certain religion because they don't consider paganism a true religion. They consider it a cult. But I might remind us that cult is the root of the word culture. In converting pagan Ireland to Christianity, Patrick, in a sense, drove the snakes out of Ireland. No longer did the belief in reincarnation hold sway. No longer did the wise men of the oak groves teach their morality to nobility. No longer were they sought in judicious decision-making, nor given the power to serve kings with their magic. We all know what came in the next centuries, the ruin of the holy sites and pagan temples, the torture and death of millions of goddess worshippers, the plunder and theft of land, wealth, art, the splitting of families and tribes, the separation of women from other women, suppression of earth-based spirituality, women's power, and even to this day, the desecration of Mother Earth. How many times have I asked myself why we let this happen? Why do we continue to desecrate the earth? Why do we still dismiss and dishonor the divine feminine? Why are women still powerless with no valued voice? Why do they stay in abusive relationships? Why did the common folk jump ship and leave their earth-based practices behind? How could they let it happen? Now, it's very easy for us sitting here in this temple, safe within the community of like minds, with our modern sensibilities, access to so much information and subsequent understanding, all of us here, centuries later in sophistication and evolution, to ask, why did they let that happen? And there is only one answer, a timeless answer, I'm afraid. Fear. Fear is such a powerful emotion. It motivates, paralyzes, shuts us down, wakes us up, heightens our awareness, dulls our senses, causes us to behave in odd and unusual ways, to live our lives either full out or barely present. We'll do something because we're afraid. We won't do something because we're afraid. I mean, really, it is something. And it can be all-encompassing. And it can also be insidious, too, something we might not even be conscious of that informs our actions or lack of them just the same. So let's take a moment now. Close your eyes and go within. Let's take a deep breath. And reconnect to your grounding cord from the beginning of the service. And if you weren't here when we started, go ahead and ground yourself to the earth as best you can. Imagine you've got roots. And then bring your attention to your third eye in the center of your forehead. Imagine it like an actual eye, and then open it up, looking out through it into your imagination. And find yourself walking along somewhere that you love to walk. Maybe on the beach or in the mountains or maybe just around the block in your neighborhood, but somewhere out of doors where the landscape is pleasing to you. And you're walking along just deep in thought. Your eyes may be taking in the beauty all around you, but your mind is on something else altogether. Your mind is preoccupied with something fearful. Find yourself thinking about something that makes you afraid. Something that causes you to react fearfully or to withdraw to protect yourself. Something that is deeply troubling and makes you worry. Determine specifically what that is now that you walk. And I know we all have lots of fears, but just choose one. Now I'm going to ask you to amplify your fear, which might be quite uncomfortable for a moment, but see if you can do it anyway. And by amplify, I mean take this fear to its worst case scenario. In your mind's eye, stop walking for a moment and thinking, oh God, what is the worst possible thing that can happen related to this fear of yours? And standing still for a moment, conjure up that scenario in your mind now. Notice that your heart might be beating more rapidly, that your breathing is faster or more shallow, tears might come. Notice any other physical changes that this amplified fear has caused. Keep breathing and just stay with it for a moment. And now a very strange thing begins to happen. It feels like you are dropping or fainting or falling, but also that you're shrinking and elongating, and all of a sudden you have shape-shifted and now you are a serpent. What is most strange about this is that it somehow feels familiar and natural, comfortable to be this close to the earth, smelling the air with your flickering forked tongue, effortlessly moving forward with your scaled body, rippling muscle to muscle. And then as that serpent, now slow your movement down to a stop so that you are simply still on the earth. Bringing that fear to mind again, and notice as you do that it seems to block your vision. And no matter how much you try, it's blurred and you can't really see. Now slowly begin moving forward again, and you find you bump up against something hard, maybe a rock or a shell, and it splits the skin of fear right in the middle of your face, and there's a feeling of relief, like some small amount of fear has eased. So slowly move forward again, and the skin that split continues to do so. Now you know what's happening. You're shedding your skin. And in doing so, shedding this fear. Like the seed bursting through your seed casing, continue to slither forward as your now dry, useless skin rolls back. And when you remember that this skin is the fear that once held you in its grip, you seem to emerge from it quickly, more easily, slithering forward until now, you slither out completely and leave it behind you. And you feel renewed, liberated, no longer so fearful, ready for a fresh start. Moving forward a bit more now without the old skin, that strange thing begins to happen again. You feel like you're rising, growing, limbs emerging until you are back into your human form, walking along in your beautiful landscape once again. Breathe deeply. And then walk yourself right back here to our temple space. And when you feel ready, open your eyes once more. It's a good technique. Not to mention you might start speaking parcel tongue. I want to say a bit more about snakes that really have nothing to do with St. Patrick or religion or paganism at all, really, but just because of our very common fear of snakes, according to one theory, is genetic. It's kind of like the fear of them, like with spiders, because they also carry venom. Right? And it's encoded within us to fear them for our safety. But goddess worship teaches us that we are not separate from nature and all of nature, from the plankton on the bottom of the sea to the serpent in the desert, has an important role in the wholeness and health of the world. Right? Like the spiders, as scary and creepy as they are, we'd be sunk without them. So here are a few things to keep in mind that might not make us want to snuggle up and take a nap in a snake pit necessarily, but at the very least, help us not to jump out of our skin when and if we encounter them in the wild. So again, from Russell McClendon's blog, he says, snakes regulate rodents. We know this, right? They eat many animals that people consider pests. Perhaps the best examples are mice and rats, which have a long history of infesting our buildings and stealing our food. But their pest control services aren't limited to mice and rats, but insects, slugs, leeches, fish, frogs, birds, and lizards can all be subject to snake management, often with snakes eating the adults as well as the eggs and the infants. But in doing this, they help control disease. By regulating rodent populations, snakes also benefit people by keeping infectious diseases in check. And also the presence of snakes indicates ecosystem health. They're an upper-level predator in many ecosystems, and they often serve as a keystone species that, as the Nature Knowledge Project defines it, exerts top-down influence. So they prevent species at lower levels from monopolizing critical resources, such as competition for space and food. So the presence of keystone predators is typically a good sign of ecosystem, implying that abundant but regulated food supply will remain at the base of the food web. So anyway, maybe that helps. Maybe not, who knows. So back to St. Patrick's Day, and to all of you who celebrate, which is many of us, since apparently everyone is Irish on St. Patrick's Day, all you need to do is wear green, drink beer, eat corned beef and cabbage, maybe carry a shillelagh, or dance a jig with a leprechaun, I'm not sure, but anyway, or stick a shamrock in your label, but remember, don't iron it. For many, it is a great celebration of their Irish heritage, and religion has nothing whatsoever to do with it, and that is really true, because St. Patrick's Day is celebrated all over the planet, and not just by Catholic or Irish countries. So, I know several people who have visited Ireland, and they all say the same thing. It may be a very Christian country, but evidence of its pagan roots is everywhere seen. One of them brought back a photo of a Sheila na gig above the entrance of a church. And for those of you who don't know what a Sheila na gig is, it's a figurative carving of a woman holding her exaggerated vulva wide open. I don't think they have one of those above the entry doors to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, necessarily. So I guess, yeah.
I have to give them one.
Yes. Love Gaia's temple. So I guess that is a testament to the fighting Irish, huh? They're not letting that go. So, you know, they'll say something like, okay, I'll leave the Grove and I'll come to your church, but I must be greeted in a certain way. Okay? Deal. For much of Ireland, the old and the new ways have melded together and coexist to this day. After all, remember, it was the Irish who refused to give up their worship of the goddess Bridget, so the church finally had to grant her sainthood. Something to be said for that stubborn streak, I think. So finally, moving from Western Europe to Asia now, the Chinese New Year was on February 9th, and that always is the second new moon after the winter solstice, and it ushered in the year of the black water snake. What synchronicity! It's called the black water snake because the color black is associated with water in Chinese astrology. And researching this, you know, water snake brings so many different perspectives on what the year means, but all of the resources agree on this. It will be a year of deep transformation. It will be a year of the shedding of skins and structures, an activity that is more subtle and behind the scenes. So just as the calm ocean on the surface does not reveal all the activity deep within it, this year is about change that occurs deep within each of us and may not yet be apparent on the surface. Water snake is a feminine sign whose yin nature balances the yang nature of last year's fire dragon. This watery energy is one of receptivity and invites meditation, reflection, and contemplation. It's a good time for honoring the feminine nature in all things, trusting our intuition, our visionary growth, sensuality, and creativity. I'd say the most important thing to keep in mind this year is don't be afraid to shed a few skins. Don't hang on. Just let them go. The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return, return, return. The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return, return, return. Fire, the water, return, return, return. The earth, the air, the fire, the water, return, return, return. May the height of the season of spring bring your renewal. May you shed any fears that prevent your growth and slither onward, staying close to the wisdom of Mother Earth. And may the wearing of the green bring health and healing to everyone. Blessed be.
Blessed be.
All right, so this is